Well, now for our October Foreign Affair, our global get-together where we take a look at events worldwide during the past month, directly and indirectly involving Australia, that have become the focus of attention or perhaps should have caught our attention. Either way, our specialists are here to bring you up to speed as everyone nominates an event or an idea that's resonated with them and that might have intrigued the rest of us. This month, it's my pleasure to welcome from the Netherlands, Jan Mellissen, who's a Senior Research Fellow at the Klingendael Institute and Professor of Diplomacy at the University of Antwerp. He's here for a conference and lecture on digital diplomacy, the era we're in now, he believes. So welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Charlie.
In Melbourne, Professor Greg Barton joins us. He holds the chair in global Islamic politics at Deakin University. And Dr. Meriden Varal is the director of the East Asia program at the Lowy Institute. A warm welcome to you all.
Thank you very much, Geraldine.
Now, first to whether diplomacy as we've known it is being disrupted by the emerging digital technologies for good or ill. For instance, President Trump's pronouncements in 140 characters or less on Twitter has people throughout the world terrified and mesmerised. And this week, his pretty vicious domestic spat on Twitter with his Republican colleagues, as well as announcing a trip to China, and they were both notable. It's led CNN to do some tweet analysis earlier this year.
We're showing you a tweet from 12 hours ago. That's the last time the president tweeted about his visit to the USS Gerald R. Ford yesterday. President Trump often tweets on Sunday mornings, but he's been quiet this morning. But let's take a look at his history at the six-month mark. You all know his Twitter handle, at Real Donald Trump. He also has at POTUS. The president has tweeted 1,026 times since becoming president of the United States. He has 34.3 million Twitter followers.
So, Jan Mellissen, here we have the lack of any gatekeeper or curator or even State Department playing a traditional oversight role. Do you think it makes for a different type of inter-country conversation, let alone interpersonal one?
Oh, yes, this is certainly a different type of international conversation and one that makes many other leaders, of course, very, very uncomfortable. America's allies, like in the East Asian region, are watching the Twitter handle of the US president very closely, and what they see and hear is not diplomatic language.
Does that matter? I suppose that's the question. It's clearly different. As I said, there's no gatekeeper there. It's blunt. Does it matter?
Well, yes. I think what we see here is that, in a way, orality is back in diplomacy. After five centuries of the authority of the written word, and we got used to diplomacy as a written profession that has gradually become more in the public eye, visible in the public eye, we see that diplomatic language is disappearing in these tweets. Diplomatic norms are being violated. So it leaves relationships with a greater degree of uncertainty. Really.
Yes, I mean, Meriden, Nick Bryant, who was an ex-BBC correspondent to Australia, well known to listeners, now working in the US, he believes e-diplomacy has coarsened public diplomacy. I mean, do you agree?
I mean, diplomacy is a tool to achieve something between countries. And as Jan has said, you know, it relies on certain kind of norms and conventions to convey meaning. And mostly, I think, what the real meaning comes between the lines. So with Trump doing this kind of straight out, off-the-cuff stuff, he's really undermining those conventions and he's confusing people as to what the messaging is and what he really means.
What do you think, Greg Barton?
Look, I think Trump never has been a conventional politician. He's never been to elected office. He has come right into the White House without any of that track record or experience. And it's not surprising. He's functioning like a reality television host, which is what he is, and not really like a politician or even like an entrepreneur and businessman.
I suppose the question is, what it really makes me think about is the codes that are learned, possibly out of wars and et cetera. I mean, we've been talking about Martin Luther on this program and the whole century that followed the drama of Martin Luther leading to the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, I discover all this, which led to sort of sovereign nations as we've known them and ushering in a whole sort of prudence, I suppose, about the way in which states talk to each other. A little bit, I suppose, Jan, as if they're on best behaviour. There's a risk of diplomats digitally dumbing themselves down if they start coming into this digital world of diplomacy. Do you think that is a risk?
Well, what we see is that it's good to take this indeed from the political leaders to the diplomatic establishments like foreign ministries, where in the Western world, certainly, not outside the Western world as much, but in the Western world, we see that diplomats are expected to go online. And that is a very unfamiliar environment to them on the one hand. On the other hand, it gives them an opportunity to show what diplomacy is all about. Diplomacy, of course, it's hard to visualize it. It's hard, even it's fuzzy for many people. Many people don't even know the distinction between diplomacy and foreign policy, have a vague idea of what a diplomatic corps is. So this gives diplomats an opportunity to enter the conversation in an arena where the public is, but it's a fast-moving environment. The social media, the use of social media is moving in a direction which is also beyond control of the diplomats themselves.
Now, I'm going to put you on the spot here. How would you describe quickly the difference between diplomacy and foreign policy?
Well, diplomacy, foreign policy, in very, very simple words, is really about the message that you want to convey in your international relationships, and diplomacy is the medium that you use to convey that message.
I mean, Jan, maybe the one thing you'd have to say is that a tweet and some of the pronouncements of people like Trump or the Israeli Prime Minister is an interesting example. You know exactly where you stand at that moment. Maybe this is not a bad thing in internet. You know, I mean, you could debate it back and forth. I wonder how you assess it.
Well, it looks like you know where you stand, but there is a lot of scrutiny of the tweets of the American presidents. And then it seems that still, in spite of his very direct communication, there is still a degree of ambiguity there. Now, if you want clarification as a diplomat or as a foreign leader, what do you do? Do you send a tweet back? Do you ask your ambassador for further clarification? What if that ambassador talking to the State Department representative doesn't have access to what the president is thinking? So as you said, it's the goal line is open, the president is communicating. It really complicates the diplomatic communication between nations.
What do the diplomats themselves tell you, by the way, Jan? Do they like it?
Well, I think there is a lot of political correctness here, that we may have the feeling that everybody's online now, that all diplomats are using Twitter and Facebook and all that. But I think we're looking at an environment, the foreign ministry, whether in Australia or elsewhere, which is still very much a mix of a few digital natives, a lot of digital immigrants and a lot of digital tourists, where people are still relatively uncomfortable with the new medium, where they are exposed to society. And of course, there are good reasons to engage with society. Diplomacy is no longer just about elites talking to elites. Diplomacy is also has a more domestic function. Taking care of Australians abroad is one of those important tasks of DFAT. And if something goes wrong there, this is immediately visible in the digital realm. Now, that's where you can imagine that diplomats feel exposed and have to be on their toes, also have to use language, which is quite different from the way they were trained in the past.
Yes, in a way, it's slowing down emotion. You just forced me to think that that's part of the role of a diplomat, is to slow down the sort of the surge of national emotions, which might lead to something more. Well, look, can I move on to an area where emotions will be very high at the moment? Because Greg Barton, closer to home this week, Marawi on the island of Mindanao in the Philippines is all but completely, finally, back in Philippine government hands after months of combat.
Ladies and gentlemen, I hereby declare Marawi City liberated from the terrorist influence that marks the beginning of rehabilitation.
So, Greg, I mean, this has been an immensely demanding battle. How would you judge it? Does it mark, in your view, the turning point in Daesh or IS's influence in the Philippines or not?
The short answer, no, it doesn't mark a turning point. It's an end of a chapter. I mean, this was the first time that ISIS emerged in the region and did something on a very large scale, united long-running militias under one banner and then took a city. This is the largest Muslim city in the Philippines, 300,000 people at least. It used to have 300,000 people. It's now in ruins, sadly. But the Islamic State forces just fall back into the jungles and the smaller towns and the islands of the Sulu Archipelago and go back to insurgency, which is what they'll also do in the Middle East, of course. They won't go away. The trouble with the destruction of Marawi in its salvation, its liberation, is it will reinforce a sense of enmity between locals and the government in Manila. People in Manila in general don't pay a lot of attention to the South. They haven't paid a lot of attention to the Marawi siege, and they won't understand the mistakes that have been made in their failure to win over the local population. And I think that sows the seeds for long-term problems. So I wish I could say it was ending, but I think this is just beginning. It's the end of the beginning.
Except that if you listen to various Islamist speakers, they do talk about the importance of holding ground as symbolic. And if they've lost ground and they're pushed back into sort of insurgents on the run and hiding, it won't be the same, though, surely. It does undermine, doesn't it, that great calling card?
Oh, absolutely. Islamic State has faced enormous setbacks with the loss of Mosul, Raqqa, now Marawi on a smaller scale. Their mantra was remaining and expanding. Well, the mantra now can't be about expanding. They're not holding territory. Unfortunately, they will remain, and that will be what will be their way of rebuilding their brand. It's not going to be such a strong brand. They won't be drawing in thousands of foreign fighters. They will be a lesser force to deal with. But as an insurgency, they're much more uncomfortable territory, whether in the southern Philippines or in the Middle East or in northern Africa. And unfortunately, that's going to be a long-running problem. So they're masters of spin. Their line of spin was about holding territory. They're now going to pivot and switch that into defending their insurgency and moving to this idea
still,
of global insurgency.
Yeah, but it may really mark that symbolic sense of having territory that you can call your own. If you lose that, surely that does make a difference.
You'd think so. I mean, as Greg said, if your brand is about remaining and expanding and you're not expanding and you're only just remaining, that's got to undermine your integrity, I would imagine.
I just wonder, Jan, whether this gets reported in the Northern Hemisphere at all. I mean, it took a while to get reported here too, and then mm-hmm. people started to gradually grasp that, and, you know, people like our own foreign minister made a great play of what was at stake, and we started sending in Orion aircraft to help, and I think probably SAS as well. Does this even make a dent in the sensibility of the Northern Hemisphere?
Oh, I'm sure this is reported. On the previous point, with ISIS losing territory, I'm just wondering, but I'm not the expert here, and I'd like to ask Greg also. With ISIS losing territory, I wonder to what extent that really makes a very big difference, because we're talking about a transnational movement here. It's not really an entity in the society of states. We don't have representation to ISIS. There is no representation vice versa. And actually, with the fighters coming back from the territories, it's harder to sort of locate and isolate the problem. And as we know, some Western countries in the Northern Hemisphere rather not have those fighters back in their countries and are working actively to prevent that with military means.
Look, I think you're entirely right, Jan. I mean, I think there probably were some in the Islamic State leadership that toyed with the idea, and this is certainly in their propaganda line, that they would become a recognized quasi-state. It's remarkable how little we know about that leadership, however. We do know that to a large extent it's former Iraqi intelligence officers and military officers, Baathists, and they surely understood that they couldn't hold Mosul for much longer than 3 years, that the physical caliphate wouldn't last. They were building a brand with a long-term game plan in mind. They fought Iran, of course, for 8 years. They know about long-term struggles. One of the strengths they do have, even when they lose a physical caliphate, however, is they appeal to local interests. So they've got the local support of people in the southern Philippines. They've got the local support of people in Syria and Iraq, to some extent in Libya and the Sinai. And that will continue, even if they don't hold territory. And as we've seen on a slightly different front with Shabab in Somalia, you know, after being driven out of Mogadishu in 2011, they've still been able to launch week after week attacks back in Mogadishu as an insurgency, and including one just recently that was probably one of the biggest single attacks since 9/11. So it's a lesser threat to deal with this sort of insurgent problem, but it's a very formidable and resilient threat.
Well, sorry,
I just wanted to ask as well, Greg, is it also the case that to some extent there's a lot of unexplored territory still for ISIS to try its hand? I mean, so it's lost territory here and there, but there are a lot of places where it hasn't even gained a real foothold yet. So in a way, it's just sort of pushing down here and popping up somewhere else. Is that the case?
Yeah, look, I think that's a fair image. I mean, this is a group that's shown itself to be masterful in adaptation and adapt to social media, what we were discussing earlier. It's reached a younger demographic, a sort of a millennial demographic. It's able to reinvent itself. So it probably doesn't entirely know where it's going. It does think long term, but it doesn't necessarily have a firm roadmap. But where opportunities arise, it'll slip into that space.
But you know, like it, just before we leave this, Iraq soldiers are said to be closing in on Raqqa, which is has been the Daesh headquarters. But the aftermath of this is proving quite tricky because it's managed to temporarily unite, believe it or not, Iraq, Iran and Turkey, all to keep the Kurds away from power in their own state. And poor old Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, has really wandered into sort of a bit of a morass there, Greg Barton. So it's hard to understand all this and to work out where we head next.
Yeah, and the story of the region, and this includes Australian and American and British involvement, is of countries thinking short-term, not thinking of unintended consequences, and thinking narrowly in terms of immediate self-interest. And the trouble is there are competing self-interests, and this kind of short-term thinking and not thinking through the consequences is bound to rebound. So for the moment, Turkey, Iraq, Iran have some common purpose, but that will quickly fade. Russia, of course, is there in the picture backing up Turkey as its new best, perhaps its only friend, but that won't last either. Yes, you're right. It is a morass, and it's I think no one knows the way through. And the trouble is, probably no one has really got the political will anymore to think long term. We all want to sort of pack up and go home as soon as we can.
Yes, could everybody please sort of get back to some rationality? I don't think the region necessarily conforms to that. Okay, Meriden Varel, hats off to you for having chosen the hugely significant Communist Party Congress in China, where President Xi Jinping, newly reaffirmed as Chinese president for another 5 years, strode down the ranks of top cadres sitting on stage at Beijing's Great Hall of the People.
With military precision, more than 2,300 hand-picked party delegates were bussed in for the start of the week-long Congress. Arriving from every part of this vast country at Beijing's Great Hall of the People, they gathered to elect the highest levels of China's government and confirm President Xi Jinping's next five-year term.
Under Xi's leadership, there have been great achievements. He's carrying on the great tradition of Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping.
So, Meriden, really they were extraordinary pictures in their own way. What for you was the key statement in this very wordy event, hours of speeches, that left its mark on you and maybe should have on us?
Well, Geraldine, there were so many things in that 3.5 hours that were catchy and exciting. I don't think there was any particular statements that stood out as the most inspirational, but I think the overall message about the party being first and foremost and that the party is going to be the way that China overcomes its, you know, its humiliation and its weakness, it's the party that's going to lift Chinese people out of poverty, China succeeding because of the party and not in spite of it, absolutely central message of Xi Jinping.
Yes, and the absolute repudiation of the whole Deng Xiaoping, hide your light under a bushel, you know, as it were, don't sprout too much hope or too much sense of yourself. I mean, he was completely the reverse of that. China's going to be there. He didn't exactly say the dominant power, but he, by goodness, you wouldn't want to take your eyes off it. That was his message, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, he's repudiated Deng Xiaoping, and not just in that kind of policy approach, but also in his whole position on the sort of separation of state and party. A lot of what Deng was trying to do in sort of technocrating the institutions, Xi Jinping has turned around.
I think that a lot of people might have thought, look, surely he's hardly a Democrat. Like amidst the various headlines, John Pomfret, for instance, a former Washington Post bureau chief, described him as a Stalinist for the 21st century. And I thought a lot of listeners might think, well, he's hardly a Democrat. He's the head of the Chinese Communist Party. How do you personally think through that dilemma about the distinctions, I suppose, between being head of the Communist Party and yet sort of changing the rules in China a bit?
Well, if I can have a go with that one.
Yeah.
I think certainly in terms of foreign perceptions, there is a problem here that the strength of the party, the top-down political system is in a way the Achilles tendon in terms of foreign perceptions, how the West sees China. At the moment, we have a less critical West looking at China. There's much less discussion of human rights. But of course, it remains very hard in the West, realizing there is a big world outside the West. In the West, it's very hard for China to keep up its soft power with the growth of its hard power.
Meriden.
Absolutely. But the thing is, while China is interested in certainly in projecting its soft power, the world is not just made up of Western countries. And China does a very good job of networking among other developing countries, or however you want to categorize them, non-Western countries. And there, their soft power is much more successful. And it's also important to remember that really the messaging and the important focus for Xi Jinping and the Communist Party is domestic.
So this is really aimed at a domestic audience primarily, is
it? Absolutely, yeah.
And of course, and that's one of the things, isn't it, Yan, you say about tweeting, funnily enough, is that often it's for a domestic political audience that sometimes things are said internationally. So you've got a bit of a tension here.
Yeah, well, it's always domestic politics always comes first, always ranks over foreign policy. So that's quite clear. At the same time, we see, of course, that China is projecting itself past the Deng era as a new sort of more assertive power, a power that will also have the ambition to influence the rule of the game. And they have a narrative. They have a narrative. The West looks empty-handed vis-à-vis a strong Chinese narrative. Mm-hmm. It's very clear, particularly for non-Western audiences, where China is going. It's less clear where the West is going.
See, Meriden, do you think he is a dictator in the making? That's what I really think is intriguing about all this. Because the Chinese have this very deliberate succession plan. That's what's operated, except for Mao Zedong.
Right.
Now, he's breaking that.
He may be breaking it. He hasn't identified a successor clearly. But there are a couple of people who are still floating around and haven't been purged by the anti-corruption campaign who are still very, very potential successors. And him not identifying a successor is not, I think we're leaping too quickly to conclude that that means he wants to stay on forever and for a very long time, past his use-by date, and become a dictator. People like Chen Min-er and Hu Chunhua are still very possibly in the lineup for Xi Jinping. And him not identifying them is possibly a function of the disadvantages of identifying a successor too soon in the game, the potential for factional alignments.
They're the younger ones. They are much younger.
They're 54 and 57, so they've got plenty of time. So, but, you know, the potential for, I mean, Mao Zedong, two of his named successors died in mysterious circumstances. Mm. I wouldn't want to be named as a successor, not that I'm in the lineup, but, you know, there's a lot of potential for risk. As I mean, people talk about it being stability naming a successor, but there's a lot of potential for risk as well.
I mean, finally, you know, Greg Barton, Australia has to find a way to live with these realities given our increasing relationship. And the US writers are very strong, you know, seeing a very definite pattern here in the Chinese. You know, the US in a way would like to put a wedge between us and the Chinese. How do you think we best thread our way through all this?
Look, I think the firmest ground is go back to what we were just discussing, that China's interests and the interests of Beijing are primarily domestic. It's stability and continuity. They're worried about providing jobs for the, you know, this very young population. Every year they've got a race to provide enough jobs and maintain stability, prevent uprisings. It's quite a nightmarish world they live with inside China. And if we recognize that they've done remarkable things in terms of achieving good governance, we can then be consistent about expressing concerns about repression without necessarily having to choose sides. I mean, China doesn't want to be at war with the world. It depends upon global trade for its own domestic survival. So there is a way of squaring the circle, but it's not a question of either sort of just kowtowing or, you know, choosing to be a panda hugger or, you know, a fear of a militant China. There aren't simple choices. Beijing itself, Xi himself, doesn't know the future. They're just trying to keep it on a stable path. And we can understand that and recognize it without compromising.
Now, I was struck this week by a statement from the new Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who announced that he wanted the kingdom to return to, quotes, moderate Islam. He was addressing a big three-day gathering in Riyadh, opening up the kingdom to overseas investing. But he told the delegates that the past three decades have not been normal. It was quite breathtaking.
We will not spend the next 30 years of our lives dealing with destructive ideas. We will destroy them today. We will end extremism very soon.
Now, Greg Barton, this was not what I was expecting him to say.
I don't think it was entirely unexpected, the sort of the force of the language and this clever pivot. I mean, of course, it's all about spin, saying, you know, it's not our fault really. This isn't who we really are. It's those dastardly Iranians who have made us do this, and now we've got to get back to our true selves. Now, you know, a historian's not going to say that's a fair interpretation, but if it provides a pathway, a narrative pathway to explaining why Saudi Arabia should reinvent itself by, you know, couching in the language of going back to its true character, and if that best assures the success of reform, then I think it should be welcomed. Of course, this is about marketing, but it's also about brand reinvention. And brand reinvention only really works if you go beyond marketing and actually look at the substance of the product.
So do you think he will?
I think he wants to. I think he sincerely wants to. And I think there's every chance of this working. The question is, the devil within the details, how much, how fast there will be pushback. One of the key things he emphasised is not just 30 years of Saudi Arabia being out of sorts, not being its normal self since the Iranian Revolution, but also that 70% of Saudis are under the age of 30. 70% of the population has been born in this last 30 years, and their future depends on us getting back, he would say, to his true character, back to being a country that can embrace modernity, provide jobs for women, allow them to get out of the house, not encumbered by limits on being able to drive or how they dress or how they mix. They really need young people to go into private enterprise. This is all about economics, as you said, and that does depend very much on social and cultural reforms.
I mean, Meriden, you look on at this and everybody knows the role of Saudi Arabia. Did you believe it?
What I wondered about it was when they're talking, when sort of the language about this modernity, and again, this is probably coming through my lens of looking at China. When you're talking about modernity, are you talking about modernity as we in the West understand it, or in a kind of modernity with Saudi Arabian characteristics?
Yes. I mean, I would believe it more if he named Wahhabism, the Wahhabi element of Islam, which is a very hardline element and has been exported around the world because of the Saudis' money, including to Australia, because that's inextricably involved in the Saudi royal family's engagement with their own society. So I suppose Greg Barton, until that's named, Salafism and Wahhabism, I don't know. Well, we'll just see where it goes.
Yeah, that's what we'll have to do, and I think that's what MBS, as he's known, will have to do, the young crown prince.
Is that what he's known as, MBS?
Yeah.
That's so cute.
Well, he's presenting himself, he's 31, he's presenting himself as a representative of his generation. I mean, this is the future of Saudi Arabia. I think he sincerely does want this reform. Of course he wants it on Saudi terms. Mm. He wants, not a Western-style democracy or modernity. But if he came into all-out confrontation with the Wahhabi clerics, that would almost guarantee failure. So he has to go step by step, and by what could be a clever ploy in saying we're going back to our true character, going back before the Iranian Revolution and finding our true Saudi selves, that may be a way that enables him to spin this and build up enough support to make the reform succeed.
Yes, it's certainly a dramatic change of tone. Look, thank you all very much indeed. Can I thank you, Greg Barton, Meriden Verrall and Jan Mellison in Brisbane? I hope you have a good trip back to the Netherlands. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Meriden.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jan Mellison is a senior research fellow at the Klingendael Institute and professor of diplomacy at the University of Antwerp. He's been visiting for a conference and lecture on digital diplomacy in the Indo-Pacific, organised by the Griffith Asia Institute in collaboration with DFAT. Professor Greg Barton holds the chair in global Islamic politics at Deakin University, and Dr. Meriden Verrall is the director of the East Asia Programme at the Lowy Institute.